It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The leaders of Wisconsin's technical colleges are pushing back on a bipartisan deal to spend down the state's surplus that was crafted by Governor Evers and Republican legislative leaders. The bill passed the assembly, but was ultimately voted down this week in the state Senate.
One provision of that $1.8 billion spending package proposal would have shifted money for the state's technical college system from local property taxes to state aid.
The presidents of Wisconsin's 16 public technical colleges wrote in an open letter on Wednesday that this would move funding, quote, from one pocket to another without increasing colleges' capacity to expand programs or train more workers.
The state's technical college system enrolled more than 290,000 students in the 2024 to 2025 school year.
To talk more about the deal and concerns it raised for funding the state's tech colleges, System President Layla Merrifield is here. Layla, welcome back to Wisconsin Today.
Thank you for having me.
So one piece of the spending bill would have shifted $50 million of state technical college revenue from local property taxes to money coming from the state. This wouldn't reduce your funding. Why are you against this?
Yeah, so Wisconsin's technical colleges exist and are in the communities where they are, and we have over 50 campuses across the state. Because those local communities decided to invest in workforce training and education in their communities, we have always been a state and local partnership, and we feel that sustaining a portion of that funding coming from our local communities ensures that we are accountable to those local communities, that those local employers know that we are invested in them just as they invest in us, and it maintains that local tie and responsiveness that we are known for. We strongly feel that those decisions about which programming should be the priority at a technical college should really, those decisions should be made at the local level. Not all of those decisions should be made in Madison, where you're just a little bit more removed from what's happening locally. And so, you know, we feel that, you know, we're grateful for the state funding that we receive currently. It is a partnership. However, there is a clear motivation by some parties to try to get us off the property tax entirely. I think severing that tie completely would be a mistake. And so we just didn't want to walk down that path any further.
Can you give us some context of what $50 million shift would do? Because, you know, about a third of the technical college system revenue already comes from state aid. Would this $50 million shift to state aid be that impactful?
Well, it would be, you know, roughly a fifth of our operating levy, and which has been reduced pretty substantially over by about half over the last 10 or so years. So it would be yet another step in that direction. Mm-hmm. Now, you might say, well, what's the difference as long as you're still getting the same amount of money? I would say that, you know, since our funding formula changed about 12 years ago, what we have seen is a lack of investment in the technical college system year after year. This is a $1.7 billion system. It serves almost 300,000 Wisconsinites every year. We provide critical services at the local level, and we received about a $3 million annual increase in the latest state budget. That is not nearly enough in terms of our cost to continue. We certainly appreciate that our taxpayers, you know, have limited means and we have to live within those means. And we are in the process of making serious changes to our operations to live within that budget. But we have not found that we compete very well in the state budget process. Our funding stability and the stability of the system really depends on that local partnership continuing.
Serious changes to our operation to live within our means, live within our budget. Can you give an example?
Sure. Well, we're making quite a few changes that are internal. We continue to modernize our operations, automate our own business operations, try to integrate AI to be as efficient as we can possibly be. But what that looks like around the state in other cases are serious layoffs, discontinuing programs, and growing wait lists for students. We have students who are waiting sometimes years to get into high demand, high pay fields. Meanwhile, on the other end, our employers are telling us that they need more dental hygienists. They need more CNC machinists. Our fire departments need more firefighters. And we are just not able to keep up with that demand on either side. So it's really becoming a bottleneck for the state's economy, for public safety, and for our employers who are already dealing with a demographic drought here in Wisconsin. They really can't afford to have 3-year-long wait lists for critical industries and critical careers.
I want to go back to something you just briefly touched on. Previous Republican proposals have sought to remove tech colleges from property tax levies entirely. You have argued that this kind of funding allows the state's technical college system to be responsive to community needs when you do have the local property taxes. Can you give an example of how this financial flexibility works in practice?
Sure. During the Great Recession, the GM plant closed down in Janesville. I think we all remember that. And hundreds of workers were suddenly thrown out of work in a relatively small community. The technical college there in Janesville, Blackhawk, suddenly, almost overnight, had an increase of about 25% in their enrollment as those workers came to us to be retrained, to change careers, or just find some new skills that would allow them to rejoin the workforce as quickly as possible. And at the same time, the state legislature cut our state aid at that time by about a third. And so we were almost entirely dependent on the local property tax base to help us respond to that critical need in that community and get those folks back to work and supporting their families as quickly as possible. So that stability, that reliability, and being able to flexibly change and pivot where our resources are to put them where they are most needed in a community is really critical and helps make us who we are, which is responsive, locally focused, and really known for bringing tremendous value to local communities across the state.
We're talking with Layla Merrifield, president of the Wisconsin Technical College System, about this hotly debated spending bill this week in the legislature. Got voted down. Notably, it would have shifted more technical college funding from property taxes to state aid. Enrollment in the state's technical colleges, they've been rising, bouncing back since COVID, still not up to highs in the mid-2010s. What is affecting your enrollments now?
Yeah, well, again, around 2010 was we were still dealing with the effects of the Great Recession, so that was an all-time high for us in terms of enrollment. Today, though, I think we have multiple trends happening that are affecting us. Number one, I think affordability in higher education is sort of front and center for working families. How am I going to pay for college? What's an affordable pathway to a family-sustaining career for me? And for almost 300,000 students every year, that pathway runs through the technical college. So we are seeing increasing demand. We are becoming increasingly an alternative place to start your bachelor's degree and get a few credits at an affordable price. We continue to see demand for, just ongoing critical services. We do most of the firefighter training in this state. We train most of the police officers in this state, correctional officers in this state. That demand is always there. EMTs, we are seeing critical shortages, particularly in our rural areas, for more EMTs. We are attempting to expand that training. We did get a small amount of funding in the last year to expand those cohorts. But again, really, we could grow our enrollments even more if we had the resources to do so. Tuition in our system, we really try to make sure it's affordable for working Wisconsinites, and that tuition on average covers about 20% of our costs. And of course, we offer quite a few programs that are just high cost. These are not your sort of stereotypical community colleges. We do a lot of technical training that's very hands-on. HVAC systems, CNC machines, firefighter training, these are all things that are high cost to provide. And so without additional resources, we cannot open up those waiting lists and bring more of those students in. You would see an even greater increase in our enrollments if we had the resources to do it.
And this echoes what this open letter from the president said, from the technical college president, saying, you know, Wisconsin is facing significant workforce shortages across nearly every sector. You're talking about years-long waiting lists in some areas. So, other than increasing funding, what can the state do to remedy those shortages?
Well, I think, you know, there are always things that you can do to try to become more efficient, but in many cases, those things are out of our hands. If it's if it's an industry accreditor that sets a certain class size, if it's a lack of, say, clinical slots for nurses or sonographers, you know, those are some critical areas where we continue to see growing demand. But without a proctor and a place for that student to go, once it's time for their workplace training, we cannot grow the cohort without those slots on the other end. So, you know, I think something that I'd also like to surface in this conversation is that, you know, Wisconsin has around 300,000 adults living in the state who never completed their high school diploma. I think that is a missed opportunity, not only for those individuals, but for our state, for our employers, and to help us address some of these demographic challenges that we're seeing. Wisconsin's technical colleges serve around 30,000 adults every year, trying to get them their high school diplomas and then transition them into occupational training. We are the best in the country at that, if you look at national data. And so I think, you know, an investment again in those sorts of resources would just pay tremendous dividends for all of us, help all of us when we, you know, need to get our roads paved a little faster, or, you know, the power lines go down after a storm and we need to see that electricity restored. If you've ever had to wait a little too long for an ambulance to arrive in an emergency, you know how uncomfortable and scary that can be. These are all things that an investment in the technical college system would mean we see an improvement in.
Layla, thank you so much for joining us. Layla Merrifield is president of the Wisconsin Technical College System. We've been talking about this bipartisan bill that failed to pass the legislature this week, and the presidents of the state's technical colleges issued an open letter explaining their concerns.
Coming up on Wisconsin Today, it's the rise and fall of the bipartisan deal that would have spent down the state's budget surplus for tax rebates, school funding, and lower property taxes.
The Inside Wisconsin Politics team from WPR and PBS Wisconsin is here. They'll break down this week's roller coaster in the state legislature and the unlikely alliance against this proposal.
That's next on WPR News.
It's Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. A blockbuster bipartisan deal to fund schools and cut taxes fell apart late Wednesday. Turns out the proposed deal had bipartisan critics as well as supporters.
The Assembly approved the measure, which would have spent $1.8 billion of the state's multi-billion dollar projected surplus. But the Senate voted down the bill even after leaders tried to amend it to secure enough votes.
To understand what happened and why, we turn to Inside Wisconsin Politics, our weekly politics roundtable. Joining in the discussion this week are WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporter Rich Kramer.
So we are going to have plenty of time here to unpack the motives of all the players in this drama that unfolded at the Capitol. But first, let's start with kind of what led to this. For people who haven't paid attention to every twist and turn of this big deal, we've been calling it, at the Capitol. Zach, what was in this thing that was negotiated by Democratic Governor Tony Evers and the Republican legislative leaders?
Well, the top line picture is it's $1.8 billion in spending, most of it one time only, looking at the projected surplus that would be available for next year. Of that, $300 million for special education funding for public schools. That's been a Democratic priority for a long time. $350 million in rebates or tax buy-downs for property taxes that would go money going to the schools, but that they would only use to reduce property taxes, not new spending. And then there were going to be individual rebates for tax filers, $300 per person or $600 for a married couple. And then we see a match to the federal plan for no taxes on tips and overtime. And Sean, a month ago, we asked, what's the possibility that this could actually happen? And my answer at the time was, well, this is the only time it could happen because we have three leaders that are all leaving the stage. It's legacy time. Well, what we didn't account for is everyone else who's still running for re-election or election in Wisconsin sinking this deal. Three legacy leaders getting the compromise wasn't enough. And to me, this is a political Rorschach test. How you view this particular deal kind of matches your view on politics. For some people and for a lot of ordinary people around the state, this was the epitome of a compromise. You get a little bit for one side, you get a little bit for the other side. Everyone can come away maybe a little dissatisfied, maybe a little happy, and money goes back to taxpayers at a time when you're seeing the price of gas go through the roof just to fill your tank up. And as they're about to run for your election, those are things that normally you'd want to see politicians pass. The other side of that test is political purity. And there are a lot of people looking at this deal saying, this isn't as good as I would like it to be, and I think we can do better when we have more power next year.
So it started out, the day, though, looked like your average special session day, like a bill that might pass. You have this big agreement by the leaders, by Governor Tony Evers, the big Democrat and the big Republicans. You had speeches to start this day, including by Assembly Speaker Robin Voss.
We can show people that we listen and that we are willing to act. And most importantly, that compromise in Wisconsin is not a dead word. Compromise is defined as getting something that you want by giving up something that your partner or your opponent wants. That is really what we did here.
So that's when the waiting game kind of began, Rich. We were both watching the Senate for a long time on Wednesday. What was it like as the day sort of played out?
It was a lot of hurry up and wait. So it's not unusual for the Senate to set a start time for their floor sessions, whether it be in a special session or a regular session, and then blow past that. That's kind of unsurprising. But this time we kept getting these notices that, oh, it's going to be at 3 o'clock. Well, it's actually 5:45. And then we just went with half-hour increments, you know, 6, 6:30, 7, 8, 8, you know, and on and on and on. I want to say it was 4 hours that it took for them to go from the first notice, you know, when the plan was to meet at 3 p.m. and when they actually met. And then once they got on the floor, you heard some of the same complaints from Democrats and Republicans about this bill that you heard in the Assembly. The opponents said that they didn't like the process of how it was, you know, thrown together. Senate Democrats were out of the picture, et cetera. And then there were concerns about costs and this being a projected budget surplus, et cetera, and how this could plunge us into a deficit in the coming budget cycle.
Yeah, so that night we had a very unusual scene kind of play out. The Assembly met after waiting all day to see what the Senate was going to do. They passed this bill in short order. The Senate is meeting at the same time, and it's clear that things are not going well there. You hear a speech from Senate Democratic Minority Leader Dianne Heselmein, who made it clear she was not happy with this bill.
This is a completely reckless proposal, stitched together in a backroom deal by three people who will not be running around and won't be here when the consequences of a multi-billion-dollar deficit comes home to roost. It's simply something I can't support.
And this bill actually fails on a vote of 15 to 18. And I know people probably think, big deal. Things pass, things fail. Bills don't actually get to the point of failure hardly ever in the state legislature. If it doesn't have the votes, it does not come to the floor, especially something as big and dramatic as this. And for the governor to negotiate this and his Senate Democrats stand unified against it to help kill it with a few Republicans is something we do not see every day. Zach, what do you think was motivating Senate Democrats here?
There's two factors. I think first is they were insulted. They were left out of the loop.
That is huge, actually.
Every single time over the past few years that they've needed to pass a big budget bill, especially with Republicans having a smaller majority in the state Senate, they've had two members that have voted against every bill. That's Senators Nass and Kapinga. They've consistently said, we can't support this extra spending. We're voting no. That means, in practice, Republicans don't have a working majority when it comes to passing that kind of legislation. They need Democratic votes. Governor Evers knows that. Senate Majority LeMahieu knows that. Everyone knows they need at least a couple Democratic votes and probably more. So the fact that they were not consulted, did not have any input on this bill, and made it clear from the very first time it was announced that they were unhappy with it, showed. And I think that showed up in that long pause in the assembly. The assembly had the votes. It was they were going to wait and see if they had the votes in the Senate. Mm-hmm. And the second part of why Senate Democrats were not in line with this comes next fall. And that's with the reelection. They are not quite certain, but very confident that they're going to flip the majority in that chamber, and that when they come to power in the next session, they will not only have a say, they will be the deciding factors in how any bills are passed and how budgets are passed. And so they can direct where that money goes. And if they think they get lucky and there's a Democratic governor and a Democratic assembly, then they're going to say all this money will be available for us to spend in ways that we prefer instead of having to compromise, which is what has sunk every possibility of all these budget surplus deals since Tony Evers has been governor. The fact that the next election might bring better outlook for each of the sides, and so they've decided not to compromise.
And I think this was a clear-cut case where circumstances matter completely. You know, if Tony Evers were running for election in November and he said, this is my big bill, Democrats, this is what I want to run on, I mean, they would have voted yes. Now, Republicans probably wouldn't have brought it up in that case. So, you know, it's a theoretical exercise. But Senate Democrats, I'm confident, would have been with him. He is not on the ballot, though, this November, as Dianne Hesselbein noted. And Senate Democrats are poised to, they think, take that majority. She has essentially been a co-majority leader on some of the big bills that have come through the Senate this year, from the budget to gambling. And so to freeze them out of talks like this, which is the way they viewed it, certainly— and end up with a bill that was pretty Republican in nature. It was about $1.5 billion in tax cuts, was not something that they enjoyed, you know?
Well, and don't forget, there is another factor when it comes to everyone looking at the next budget in the next year, and that is there's a lot of people who think we may be looking into a recession.
Yeah.
So most of this surplus is a projection of what the economy is going to bring in for tax revenues. If there's an economic downturn in the next 6 months, that money disappears all by itself without having been sent out. So you send it out, even though most of this is one-time spending, it may not be there next year. Now, they say even in the worst of circumstances, at least the state will have a little bit money to start the next year with. So that is a legitimate concern, considering where gas prices and grocery prices are right now, and with no end to a war in Iran, that the economy could shift and go down and these tax revenues may not materialize.
Rich, the Senate Democrats don't have this power if Republicans just stick together and all their members vote for the bill negotiated by their leader, Devin LeMahieu, and Assembly Speaker Robin Voss. In fact, in the Assembly, all the Republicans did stick together, and they voted for that bill. So what's going on in the Senate with a few Republicans there who decided, yeah, we're just not going to do this?
Well, what was surprising is that two of the three Republicans that voted against this proposal, they're not running for reelection. So maybe that made them feel freer to speak their mind. But as Zach mentioned, you've also got Senator Steve Nass as one of them, and he's pretty well known for voting against, especially spending, you know, large spending packages. So it seems like Devin LeMahieu didn't have the sort of control over his caucus that Robin Voss did in the assembly. That's been pretty obvious, given the past bills where you needed Democratic support to get them over the finish line. But what's also been really interesting is seeing Republicans attacking Republicans after the fact. So in particular, Senator Van Wangard, who is retiring, he went on social media afterwards, after the bill failed, and said it was a good deal for Wisconsin, but, you know, every Dem and Nass and Kapinga and Rob Hutton wanted to spend more and keep more of your money. So you've got a Republican saying that Steve Nass wants to keep your tax dollars from you, which is pretty interesting in the grand scheme of things. But you also had Democrats kind of saying good riddance Tony Evers. I mean, it's just really fascinating to see this breakdown. It's just unlike anything I've ever seen. And I wanted to ask both of you, Sean, how many times in your careers have you seen a bill pass, you know, this kind of bill with this kind of buildup where you would expect the votes have to be there before it gets to the floor to avoid embarrassment? How many times have you seen it clear one chamber and then die in the Senate?
It is pretty rare. I thought of a couple. One, the vote on state employee contracts ahead of when Scott Walker took office.
Another one that featured lame ducks.
It did. I mean, this weird stuff happens at the end here when everybody's position has changed. Circumstances matter. But you had the Assembly Democrats passed new contracts for state employees. The thought was that that would protect them when Scott Walker took office. And Senate Democrats, led by Russ Decker and Senator Jeff Plaley at the time, voted no, and they failed. So it has happened. Another one on ethanol mandate way back in like 2006, I think. But it is pretty sparse the way this stuff happens.
But it does point out exactly what we're talking about. Once a politician is no longer running for re-election and they become a lame duck, they lose a lot of control. What's most impressive about all this is Robin Voss holding his entire caucus together. Even though he's going to be exiting stage right, he still has enough to keep his chamber together. Senator LeMahieu really never had firm control over Republicans in the Senate. That's always been called herding cats over there, so that's not terribly surprised. Kapinga and Noss have made it quite clear. But all of these people leaving office really gives people a lot of freedom to think about their own interests next year, completely aside from what you would expect in the typical bill process.
Yeah, Steve Noss, I mean, has been a thorn in the side to leadership for his entire career, basically, or at least
unapologetically, the
part that I've observed anyway. And can you imagine him on his last vote ever in the legislature saying, you know, I'll take one for the team for Robin Voss. I mean, I think it's pretty predictable that he was going to be a no vote. But let's kind of unpack where Assembly Republicans were on this and why they decided we're going to take this vote, because I think by the time that they both chambers got to voting at night, I bet you Assembly Republicans knew darn well that this thing was going to fail in the state Senate, and they wanted to take this vote anyway. Why?
Because they're all up for re-election this fall. Everyone that's not retiring has an absolute desire to go back to their constituents and say, I was willing to put $300 in your pocket. I was willing to give more to the schools. I was willing to lower your property taxes. It's not my fault this failed. That does bring us around to some of the interesting calculations that we're looking at, especially on the Democratic side. So one of the people I was watching is Jeff Smith, who's a Democratic senator. He's the assistant majority leader, so he's pretty high ranking in his caucus. He's going to move up if they control the chamber. He voted no on this. His staffers tell me he was no the entire time, mainly for the structural deficit concerns. But within his district, one of the Assembly Democrats, Jody Emerson, voted yes. You go south from there into La Crosse. Brad Paff in the Senate voted no. Within his district, Joe Billings and Steve Doyle, two Assembly Democrats in competitive districts, both voted yes in the Assembly. They understand what it's like to go back to the voters and have to say, oh, no, I voted against this because we'll spend it better next year when people are feeling the pinch right now. There's a lot of political calculations that go into some of these moves, and looking unified as a team does help. We also saw another state Senate race. Howard Markline voted yes. He's right in a competitive district. Jenna Jacobson, the Assembly Dem who's running against him, also voted yes. It would put her in a terrible position. Easy marketing for Markline if she voted no on this deal. So some of this, it has to be political maneuvering.
And, you know, I think you could look at this bill and say potentially it's a little gimmicky, right? You're going to like spend almost $900 million just on these $300 checks and it's going to be gone. You have lawmakers on the record from both parties for bills like this in the past saying, oh, that's a gimmick. We can't do that. But do you want to be – which side of that gimmick do you want to be on when you're doing doors in November and people are struggling with costs? It's a popular kind of bill, giving people money and saying that you work together with the other side.
So, Sean, let's look at the outside players in this, because Tom Tiffany was a big factor in this. I've seen some Republicans online saying he would have been better off being quiet, given how it played out. Instead, he did come out against this bill, and he was on the record talking to at least one state senator who did vote for it, but weighing in on his concerns about this bill. What do you make of that?
Yeah, from a practical perspective, I get it. From a political perspective, I do not. I don't understand what he was doing. What I mean is, from a practical perspective, if Tom Tiffany thinks he's going to be governor, then I bet he wants to either have that money in there so that he doesn't take office with the deficit, or if the economy does okay, maybe he wants to come in as governor and throw a special session for a Tom Tiffany tax cut, not a Tony Evers tax cut, you know, get things started off right. From a political perspective, I don't know why you come out against this. I just don't. It's like a theoretical exercise because you're not in there voting. But like, why come out in against a big tax cut? And why attack Tony Evers? Like, he's not on the ballot. All these Democrats who are also against this bill might be running against you in November. So how do you differentiate yourself here by agreeing with them? I'm not sure. Now, Rich, one question I had for you that we kind of traded notes on throughout the night was, will voters actually remember this? Like, will anybody be rewarded or punished?
You know, it's a huge question. All of what you're saying makes sense to me, someone who's been really following this, but, you know, I also remember being at a Supreme Court election night event and a fella at the hotel not knowing there was an election that day. So there's a part of me, I'm always skeptical that this sort of thing will stick in a voter's mind. It's different, I guess, if you're getting your door knocked consistently and people are reminding you of that, or if you see a lot of commercials. But, you know, in the grand scheme of things, a $300, $600 check, that's a big deal. But, you know, all the political infighting and everything like that, I'm not sure if people will carry that all the way to November.
There's a lot else going August. Out there right now in national and world politics, that's for sure. That's all the time we have for today. Thanks for joining us. This has been Inside Wisconsin Politics.
That was a roundtable discussion with WPR Capital Bureau Chief Sean Johnson, PBS Wisconsin Senior Political Reporter Zach Schultz, and WPR Political Reporter Rich Kramer.
Wisconsin Today airs the Inside Wisconsin Politics podcast every Friday. You can also download it and watch it at both WPR.org and PBSWisconsin.org.
And if you have a question you'd like the reporters to discuss, email it to InsideWisconsinPolitics@WPR.org. Please include your first and last name in your message.
Coming up, there is a campaign to make a rare dragonfly the state's official insect. Hear the story of the Heinz emerald dragonfly, once believed to be extinct.
What is the most striking feature about the Heinz emerald dragonfly is its incredibly beautiful emerald eyes.
That's next on WPR News.
You're listening to Wisconsin Today. I'm Rob Verrett.
And I'm Kate Archer-Kent. It's time for Wisconsin Life. Constant distractions are all around us in our daily lives. And even when we try to find an escape in nature, technology can often pull us away from truly appreciating our surroundings.
In this week's edition of Wisconsin Life, writer Jill Sisson-Quinn reflects on ways we can slow down, observe, and reconnect with the world around us.
I've hiked the Ice Age Trail's New Hope segment for 20 years. My hiking regularity has waxed and waned over time. And now that I'm back at it again, I've been thinking about what it means, good and bad, to be a creature of habit. When I first started hiking this trail, I sat in the forest for hours, with no phone, no media but my Newcomb's wildflower guide or my Peterson's field guide to birds. I had nothing to do but observe. I could turn over the same log at the top of the hill above Severson Lake to reveal a certain spotted salamander anytime the humidity was right. Year after year, I watched a single yellow lady slipper bloom. I knew exactly where to look for its distinctive parallel-veined, finely haired leaves each late May. Halfway up the second hill, before the first of two homemade deer blinds. Ironically, habitually walking the same trail also increases your chances of seeing something not so habitual. like the time my first dog went nose to nose with a badger in some sort of Disney-style interspecies hello. With my second dog, I tend to hike through, because if we do pause, that ever-present encyclopedia now in my back pocket pulses with the promise of answers to all of the questions that pop into my mind while walking. My phone is silenced, but there's nothing so loud as the world's brain in the palm of your hand when you're alone in the forest. And once my phone is out, say to ID a flower whose name I can't recall, its apps are like overripe berries along the trail I can't resist tapping into my palm to devour. So I avoid stopping to prevent that other habit, checking my phone, which research shows we touch somewhere between 352 and 2,617 times a day. My habitual hiking this spring has revealed that although my salamander is gone, or actually his log now decomposed, the yellow lady's slipper still pops up in the same place, now a trio. I also see a scarlet tanager on the same branch on successive days. Like me, it too is a creature of habit. I likely its surprise. One day, at the low point before the trail's steepest hill, from a tangle of brush about 10 feet to my right, a coyote rises and moves away from me. It is yellow, brown, black, and not lithe, but lanky. Rather than scamper off, it simply exits my view into the undergrowth. I've seen coyotes before, but never this close or this slow motion. Is it following me from a distance? How many times has it watched me on this walk? My walks this spring have shown me the rewards of being a creature of habit, but also reminded me to pay attention to the habits I form. As often as we check our phones, we should check our forests, tapping into nature's algorithms, not just artificial ones. In the joy of information availability, we have forgotten what the brain really wants. Not necessarily to know, but to notice and to wonder.
Jill Sisson-Quinn is a writer who lives in Scandinavia and central Wisconsin. This piece was produced by Tyler Ditter.
Wisconsin Life is a co-production of Wisconsin Public Radio and PBS Wisconsin in partnership with Wisconsin Humanities. Additional support comes from Lowell and Mary Peterson of Appleton. This is WPR News.
Should Wisconsin have a new state insect? There's a campaign to make a rare dragonfly the official insect of the state, and it got support in the Wisconsin Conservation Congress survey last month.
The Heinz emerald dragonfly was believed to be extinct for decades, but it was rediscovered in Door County in 1987. Now the Ridges Sanctuary in Bailey's Harbor is a rare habitat for the endangered species.
We're checking in with the Ridges Sanctuary about the Heinz emerald dragonfly, its habitat in Door County, and the campaign to make it the state insect of Wisconsin. Tony Koshonis is director of research at Ridges, and Victoria Holderer is an applied research ecologist there. Victoria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you. Thanks for having us.
And Tony, thanks for being with us.
Thank you for having us here today.
Tony, let's start with you. Most people probably haven't seen the Heinz emerald dragonfly in person. Can you paint us a picture of what it looks like?
Well, it's a small little guy. It's not one of the bigger dragonflies. I would classify it as a medium size, probably about 2.5 inches in length. But what is the most striking feature about the Heinz emerald dragonfly is its incredibly beautiful emerald eyes. There are other emerald dragonflies that we have up here, but that's the first thing that's noticeable about the Heinz emerald dragonfly are the eyes. And then it's got some very interesting stripes on its thorax or on its chest area. And from a profile, some people say it resembles a helicopter with just a hint of a curved abdomen. So it's not real large, not real small, beautiful little guy, very, very quick as many dragonflies are. But the eyes are what really are the noticeable features first. And then, of course, the thoracic stripes.
And Victoria, the story of the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly is pretty amazing, believed to be extinct, as I understand it, for a few decades. Can you tell us the story of its rediscovery in the 1980s in Door County?
Sure, yes. It was first described back in 1931, and some of its range, you know, stretched all the way to Idaho and Indiana. It's been known in different populations, even as far south as Alabama. Back in the 1950s, it was believed to have gone extinct. The area in which it was previously located, it could not be found. And then during the 1980s, it was rediscovered in Door County, Wisconsin. So that's, of course, where we are today, and rediscovered in the habitats of Door County, Wisconsin wetlands. And it was then federally listed as a federally endangered species in 1995.
And Tony, what is it that led to, well, the decline, the belief it was extinct, and the still federal endangered status? What were the threats? What are the threats to the this dragonfly?
The threats are multiple, Rob, and primarily wetland degradation is a very serious issue for this dragonfly, as well as other organisms. But this particular organism needs very, very high quality wetlands, and it needs a very high quality groundwater that go along with those wetlands. And along with the wetland degradation, its life cycle also makes it a bit more susceptible to problematic situations. Many insects, many dragonflies go through a larval period where it's a relatively short larval period. This guy has a larval period anywhere from 4 to 5
wow.
years. So in any case, if there's any sort of environmental disruption, you can essentially wipe out numerous generations of this particular insect with one dramatic situation in a wetland area. So it really is a combination of those things, but primarily it's the wetland degradation and the susceptibility to wetland pollutants.
And Victoria, Tony was just giving a hint, I think, at this. What is it about the ecosystem in and around Ridge's sanctuary that makes it a good habitat for the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly?
Wonderful question. The Ridges Sanctuary, we are known for our ridges and swales. In our ridge and swale habitats, these were caused by years, thousands of years of shoreline Lake Michigan, creating these very intricate and close together pockets of wetlands. Not to get too in depth into, you know, how those were formed and everything about those wetlands, but primarily the spring fed, very clean, clear, cool water is a very important part of the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly's life. Those habitats, small, calcareous, marshy streams, wetlands, sedge meadows, those are all areas that are common at the ridges because of the ridge and swale habitats that we have, as well as the abundance of springs that we have here. So we have very clean water and perfect habitat for the Heinz to have their larvae at as well. And in addition to that, the larval habitat here is wonderful, but we also have a lot of habitat open areas alongside woodlands that are perfect areas for the adults to hunt and fly through for catching prey. So it, back to back, it's a perfect, you know, just enough habitat for all stages of their life cycle to let them live very happy lives here.
And Victoria, maybe a dumb question. I know what a ridge is. A swale, is that the area between ridges?
It is, yes. A swale is a type of wetland. Usually it's a slightly smaller area than, you know, your typical large-scale sedge meadow or, you know, open area. But a swale is, yes, another word for wetland.
We're talking about the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly, a rare species with a home in Door County. Tony Kishonis and Victoria Holderer are with us from the Ridges Sanctuary in Bailey's Harbor. Tony, Ridges is backing this campaign to recognize the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly as the state insect, and that would move the current insect, the Western honeybee, to the official agricultural insect. What are you hoping to accomplish by aiming for that recognition?
Well, first and foremost, it's a really cool little insect, and I think that's really, you know, important for us up here. But I think it's the idea that part of our mission, part of our pillar system up here at the Ridges Sanctuary is education. And I think by selecting the Heinz Emerald Dragonfly as this particular recognition in the state of Wisconsin opens up all sorts of possibilities for the educational components that will go along with it. And it leads into so many different areas. I know Victoria was discussing about the high quality
wetland areas. We talked about the high quality groundwater, but it opens up all sorts of avenues about the importance of this particular animal, but broadens out to really the importance of many different organisms as far as the ecosystems as a whole. And yes, it's a marvelous little insect. We're certainly biased up here, but I think it offers the opportunities to expand the educational outreach for not only the Heinz emerald dragonfly, but all the associated things that go along with it. And it really does provide a great platform for this aspect of our pillar structure up here, with education being one of the key aspects that we try to get across at the Ridges Sanctuary.
Victoria, what kind of conservation efforts are going on there at Ridges that are going to help not just this dragonfly, but other dragonfly species and the rest of that wetland ecosystem?
We have a couple different research initiatives here. Some of them are more plant-based than animal, but we, of course, have a wide abundance of different species, one of which, the dwarf lake iris, a state-threatened species. That is a plant that we are researching right now and looking at its growth and habitat and looking for the best type of habitat for it to grow in and how we could aid in its restoration efforts. We also study Ramshead orchids up here. We are working on our germination protocols for Wisconsin orchid species in hopes of helping restore their populations and figuring out what the best habitat for them is. And then another recent project that we just started is the Boreal Climate Survivability Project, which is a tree planting project where we are studying the success, mortality, and survivability rates of planted trees in restoration efforts in Door County. So all of these combined, you know, they're all important aspects of habitat here in Door County, here at the Ridges, and definitely is habitat that is shared by the Heinz emerald dragonfly.
Tony, if somebody's listening thinking, hey, I want to see this Heinz emerald dragonfly in person, what is the best timing for them to visit Ridges?
Oh, boy. Timing of all our native critters up here is sometimes quite variable. And I know for sure if I quote you an exact date, it's not going to happen 20 years out of 21 years. So what we would recommend to folks is that they will start emerging from their last larval stage, generally speaking, in June, and are very prevalent in July into the first part of August for sure. The adult dragonfly has a relatively short lifespan, roughly 6 weeks, give or take. And with this dragonfly, they don't emerge all at once. So we give people a window of the latter part of June. July is pretty consistent, though who knows with any given year. And then even into August, and they have been sighted as late as September. So it's quite a range, but July would be probably the target month that I would suggest for people to take a look at it. But boy, they do not sit around very much. So people are going to have quick eyes and get lucky and really try to focus in on that body shape and body morphology and then look for the eyes.
And we'll leave it there. Victoria, thanks for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And Tony, thanks for being with us today.
I really appreciate the opportunity, Rob. Thank you so much.
That was Tony Koshonis and Victoria Holder from the Ridges Sanctuary in Door County talking about the endangered Heinz emerald dragonfly. The Ridges Sanctuary is Wisconsin's first land trust protecting the state's most biologically diverse ecosystem. It's located in Bailey's Harbor. If you want to get a glimpse of those emerald eyes on the Heinz emerald dragonfly right now, we've got pictures up on our website. Look for an article about the dragonfly with some pics at WPR.org. That's WPR.org.
we just learned about a rare dragonfly in Door County. And earlier this week, we invited you to share your stories about local insects and asked if you were doing anything to help your local species.
Nick from La Crosse County sent us an email. Nick writes, I currently have a pollinator garden in my yard trying to help the bees and butterflies on their journey.
And Nick took things a step further, telling us, I've also written a children's picture book called Pollinator Parade, and all the profits benefit the nature place here in La Crosse.
Thanks for the note, Nick. I'm right there with you. At my old place, I grew a lot of milkweed to help monarch butterflies. And of course, I have involuntarily donated a lot of nutrition to Wisconsin's mosquito population over the years.
Keep sharing your stories with us. Email wisconsintoday at wpr.org or call or text at 888-642-0232. Wisconsin Today producers include Trevor Hook and Joe Tarr.
Our technical directors are Tyler Ditter and Sarah Hopeful, and Tim Peterson is our acting executive producer.
Learn more about us at wpr.org/Wisconsin Today. I'm Kate Archer-Kent.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to WPR News.